Welcome, listeners of Oh My Word podcast. We have an amazing bonus episode for you today. And let's just let music take us in. Special guest author. Wait for it, I'm so excited. S.J. Kincaid is here with us today. Woo!
Hello! Yay! Thanks for having me on.
It is an honor and a pleasure, and we're so excited. And for those of you who said, who are you talking about? I don't know if you're paying attention to the books that are coming out these days, because SJ's newest book, which is actually the third of a trilogy called The Nemesis, just came out and is part of the Diabolik series. And this is the second, trilogy that you've written, correct? Because you have two.
Yes, it is. Yes. My previous trilogy was the Insignia trilogy, and it was a little on the younger end of YA. And this is definitely kind of on the older end of YA.
Yeah, it's definitely definitely upper YA. But after this is done, if you haven't read the books, you'll go get the books. And then after this is done, if you've already read the books, you can go reread them. So we'll give you time afterwards to go look at them again. But let's get started. Let's get into this. So we always like to start off with the basics of how did we get to this point? How on earth did you get into writing? How did all that happen? Either brief or long, however you want to, that much detail you want to go into.
Okay. Well, I first got into writing when I was very, very young. And it was because my older sister, who's actually published also as Meredith Durand, she writes romance, and she always wanted to be a writer. And she's 4 years older than me. I wanted to do everything my older sister did. You know, I'd like follow her around. I'd try to basically imitate everything she did. So when she started writing, I also started writing. And I kind of have this distinct memory of one of the early things I sat down to write, and Meredith like looked in, she's like, "This is just the last unicorn." Like, things like it was pretty much the same wording I'd taken for the book, but you know, I was like pretty young at that point. But it was something I just kept up as a hobby, and you know, over the years, I did it more and more. And obviously, you get better the more you do it. Like around middle school, there was that phase when everything that you read, you kind of write just like that afterwards for a while, and then I sort of found my own voice over time. It wasn't until I never seriously considered writing as a career, just because it's notoriously difficult to get into, and that's definitely, it's a little more accessible now, actually, than it used to be before the internet, but it was just something I kept doing, and then when I was out of college, and my realistic career prospects were just not panning out. My best friends and I in Chicago, we, as a joke, started writing a book together. And I always took for granted that I could never actually write an entire book because I would start and stop so many things. And I still start and stop a ton of things I never finish. But the thing is, we just kept writing this and writing it, and then one day when I was at work, because you know I was obviously not very good at my job, so I actually I finished that first manuscript, and it just blew my mind. It's like, oh my gosh,
wow!
I can actually do this as a career, because once you finish that first one, it really all becomes possible for you.
Oh yeah!
Once you've finished a whole story, it's like, and that one didn't sell. It took me 7 books to actually sell one, but
wow!
You know it. It set me off. It set me on course to where I am now.
Wow. And when you say 7 books until you actually sold one, is that till you got an agent who could sell a book, or you got an agent somewhere in between then?
We got an agent with that very first manuscript.
Oh,
but,
wow.
The agent was not a really credible one. Oh. And she just, you know, we would never hear from her. Or apparently she was telling people she was sending things out and she never did. And so that just kind of went awry, and you know, she actually did sell an author that I know, and then she just disappeared on all her clients one day, which was bizarre, but luckily we'd left her long before then. And then I got a different agent with the third book that I wrote, which was the one, 2 through 7, I wrote by myself, and with the third book I got an agent, and she could not sell it, and I was so excited, you know, because I was like, this is a real agent. But no, she could not sell it, and she didn't like my 4th or 5th book, so I left that agent. finally got an agent for my sixth book, but he could not sell it. And then my seventh book was the one that sold. So
Wow. And that's Insignia? That's the Insignia series started that.
Yes, that is Insignia. And Insignia, I was in nursing school by that time because I was like, okay, this is getting ridiculous. I can't just keep writing things that don't sell. I need to actually have a credible career. So I was in nursing school, and I was like 1 week from graduating when Insignia finally sold. And, you know, if Insignia hadn't sold, I was like, this is the best thing I've written. It may be the best thing I'll ever write. And I was like, I don't know if... with this book, if I can't sell this, I don't know if I can sell anything. So I was not a very good nursing student. I would spend too much time thinking about what I wanted to write instead of learning all the details. Yeah.
Right.
And so I was like, I'm just going to stop writing for 10 years if this doesn't sell and just get good at my job. So luckily it sold.
Yeah, we are very grateful for that. Just because that you thought at the time that Insignia was the best book you ever wrote, now that you're, I guess, six books later, do you still think Insignia, I guess, is still kind of a turning point for you? Or do you see, you know, this is always going to have a special place because this is my first sold, but I do think every book I write makes me a better writer. You know, I am getting better at this or better hold on things. Or is it, you know, does it kind of lose its status or it just has a special status now?
Insignia is always, I love Insignia more than anything else I've ever written.
Right.
I think Diabolik has actually gotten much more of a response, I guess. But, it, you know, Insignia had something really, it was really special for me. And I think that is because it was the first trilogy. And also just, I loved those characters so much. So I still kind of feel sad sometimes when I'm like, oh, that story's done. But, you know, I don't know. I think my writing has improved quite a lot. You know, and it's interesting because Diabolik and Insignia are two such different stories. Diabolik and Insignia are two such different stories.
Right.
Diabolik is so serious, and Insignia was kind of a jokey, humorous story that then became very serious over time.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, you never know. You never really know what's going to happen. The third book that I wrote, the third manuscript that never sold, I thought at the time, this is the best book I'll ever write.
Yeah,
I was so sure of it, and I was so depressed when that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And I looked back at it the night after I sold Insignia, and I was like, oh my God, this is not very good.
Because even... even for my, when someone ever asked, like, what's my favorite book? Like, if someone asked me about my books, which one's your favorite? I said, whichever one I'm working on, because I have to put so much time into it. But honestly, I do have, you know, each one has its place, I guess you could say. So, yeah. So here's something,
Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah, well, so here's something I'm wondering about, that you wanted to, that you said that you always wanted to imitate your sister, but you didn't become a romance writer. I mean, there is romance. Well, I know this series is romance in it, but Diabolik is sci-fi. And I think Insignia is also, it's not specifically a romance, right? That also is sci-fi-ish kind of. So how did that happen?
Well, we got published in two kind of different ways. I was somewhere around that third manuscript. And she had sort of a, when she was in college, she sent out a manuscript that, you know, it didn't get picked up by a publisher, but it was just an amazing book, and it went on to be her novel called Duke of Shadows. And I was in Chicago at this time, and she was also in Chicago, and I just mentioned to her, like, because I had books on my mind, because I was doing my writing in secret. I didn't want to tell anyone unless I actually sold something.
Right,
so,
yeah.
You know, with her story, I was like, you know, I really liked that romance novel set in India during the mutiny. I thought that was amazing. And it sort of put it on her mind that night. She looked on a website that she would go to, and she saw that they had the very final day to enter this romance novel writing contest.
So she just
sent that manuscript in without thinking much about it. And she won, and she got published by Pocket Books.
Oh, nice.
Off of that competition. So, I mean, that's what launched her into romance. And yeah, I think my sister writing romance really did help me, because when it came to looking at the Diabolik, this was my first time really just centering romance in a story.
Right.
You know, I had some of it in Insignia, but obviously it's kind of a different audience. Boy main character. They're not going to think about things the same way.
Right.
Diabolik from the beginning was just centered around these two characters. And I kind of conceived of both Tyrus and Nemesis as main characters on their own. And then I just didn't want to write another guy point of view. I wanted to change. I wanted something very different from Insignia. And so it's like when it came to writing a romance between these two, I kind of had to, you know, I was like, Mare, help me figure out what I'm doing right or wrong here. And she just had such good pointers. Like, for example, when she read it, she's like, you know, okay, so Tyrus originally, he came into the story maybe like, I don't know, 100 pages in.
Right.
She suggested something where they meet sooner. And this was basically what her advice was. She suggested they meet sooner. He sees something in her that no one else sees. She sees something in him that no one else sees. And from that, I, you know, thought of the scene where they meet in virtual reality and, you know, and she's in Sidonia's avatar and he's acting like he's a mad prince.
Yeah.
So it's just stuff like that that I just don't think of. And she could point out where things were needed. And that was extremely helpful with this entire process, though.
Right. Well, because especially you see within the third book that the romance or part of the setup is that Nemesis starts seeing herself as being more of a person, I guess, because someone can love her and see these things in her. So that almost, even though it's like not a romance, but it kind of is, because that leads her to make certain decisions. Instead of just being this like crazy, because especially that first, when we first see her, she's all about like, bash people up, bash people's heads in. And then she moves away from that. To more of like a, okay, let's build something together. Let's do something like that. So it's interesting that you chose.
A lot of the series, I mean, so much of it is about someone who's sort of grown up dehumanized just because of her role in life.
Right.
And so, you know, the first book was kind of her stepping outside the boundaries, like being in the place of Sidonia Empyrean. So she was experiencing the world with people reacting to her like she's Sidonia. And sort of finding her own surprising humanity, you know, in the new context, in the new situation, in this world where she's always been told that she's kind of basically not a person. She has no soul. And so it's been interesting trying to balance, because I didn't want her to only find her humanity because someone falls in love with her. I wanted her to grow as a person, and that's kind of what enabled her, you know, to really be, you know, she grows as a person, and that only then is she really able to be the partner of someone else, you know?
Right.
Because she doesn't find her personhood within him. She finds it within herself, and then, you know, for example, with Nemesis and Tyrus being intimate, I wanted to wait very deliberately until she was just entirely sure of herself. Right. As a person, as an equal to him, you know. So it was kind of an interesting balancing act in the course of the series.
Yeah, well, they always, actually, I don't remember if you specified this, because I was trying to remember this, that the Diaboliks are people that are trained to be like this, or they're actually created like in a lab or something?
Yes, they are. They're created in a lab. But basically my idea with Diaboliks is always just that they're created. They're basically outwardly human.
Right.
They have a lot of what's not human in them. That's what makes them strong. It's what makes them deadly. But a lot of, from the beginning, I was thinking, this is basically a human being who has been dehumanized, who has just been treated like an animal, taught to regard herself that way. And so it's kind of just, I mean, it just what happens to people in real life when they're just absolutely just treat like they're less,
right?
And they internalize that,
right, which is with all the cage, well, not cage fighting, with the created animals, the animals fight each other. That's what you first kind of, that's when you first see her saying, like, wait a second, like, that's me, not really me, and this is all wrong, and we can't treat people like that. That's when we really first see that. That's an interesting, because even by the third book we have to debate, like, even if she didn't have Tyrus, would she still be the person she's discovered herself to be? And it seems like the answer would be yes. Like, with or without Tara, she's still going to be her. And not just go back to being a diabolic. So that really does show that she... I gotta say, as a side thing, the names of the diabolics are great. I don't know how, like, Anguish and Havoc and all these names. I don't know how... You just talk, look at, like, synonyms in a dictionary for everything that means pain.
Well, it's like, you know, also it's a society where, you know, you have this extremely elite technocratic class, essentially, and they've sort of created these, they're kind of these humanoid creatures that are human, but they don't give them human status. And so just the idea was also with diabolics, with servitors, with, you know, I think the other one were Harmonids, etc. These creatures that were, they just named them after their function, you know, right. And then they sort of the diabolics had naming themes that were kind of like hostile or, you know, dangerous sounding names. And, you know, and then servitors were things like leather or yellow or just random words that were just, you know, like you wouldn't name a person. That.
Right, or even like your pet, yeah.
Yes.
I keep speaking of the names. I keep thinking that Tyrus's name is Titus, and then like, no, it's not Titus. Was it? Was that a consideration?
Emperor Titus. Yeah. There was actually I noticed. I sort of went for Romanesque names.
Right.
So much of this was inspired by I, Claudius. Wanted to write a science fiction I, Claudius for young adults, but obviously Tyrus kind of in the Claudius character point.
Right.
And then I was sort of looking at Roman emperor names. I was like, oh, Titus. And then the next one's Domitian. So it's like, I guess that's why those came into my head.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Cause I guess also because you do have the opulence of the Roman empire that fell from, it just became too much for itself kind of. So,
yeah.
So do you see when you're plotting, when you started the first book of the Diabolic, you knew that it was going to be a trilogy from the outset?
I had an idea for where I would take it. I kind of always, I'm going to spoil the Nemesis a little, but I was always going to, you know, I always had in mind, you know, they, for example, I, Claudius, which this was sort of based around. I, Claudius focuses upon the Roman Emperor Claudius, and he's a Republican, and the Roman Empire has just become the Empire. And he wants it to be a republic again. And so a lot of Claudius, when he ascends to being the emperor, he sort of starts to realize he's ruling too well. He's just strengthening the empire. And so he decides to become just a malevolent tyrant to destroy his own empire.
Well,
you know, over time, and then he doesn't succeed. This version I kind of always had in mind, I was like, yeah, I want to do that, but I want him to succeed.
Right.
So I knew that's where I wanted to take it, but again, I wasn't, you know, especially just having written those first six books that didn't sell, and I wrote three in between the Diabolic series and Insignia, which didn't sell, and I'm glad they didn't sell, because I didn't think they were, I wouldn't want them out there under my name.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But the thing is, I always plan for one book and then have a vague idea in mind for what I would like in the future, if I can continue it. Right. So of course, some of them, the next thing I'm writing, I'm just planning for one standalone, absolutely. You know, but, you know, so I had vague plans, and then as soon as I could continue it, I was like, okay. So I have to do books two and three, and they'll be awesome.
Right. And then do you ever get some sort of audience feedback that you have to, like, don't get into my head right now, I'm trying to write a book. You're like, oh, that's an interesting point. Maybe I'll see if I can fit that in somewhere.
I don't know. I think it's really, I'm trying to think. No, I guess I don't really incorporate a lot of feedback while I'm writing something. I mean, maybe I'll keep it in mind for something else I write in the future, but it's like generally I have a pretty clear idea of where I want it to go.
Right.
So, like a lot of people really didn't like the cliffhanger at the end of book two.
Yeah!
I totally made it as painful as possible, but you know, I was going to do book three and it would flip things around a little, so.
Yeah, well, I don't know how much we could get it, like if it gets too personal, but also because then there was the gap between book two and three. So you had the cliffhanger, and then you just left us hanging there for like 3 years.
I know. I feel bad about that. Did not expect it to take so long. I sat down, wrote out, I think I originally asked my editor for an extra like 3 months or so. And they were like, well, we don't know about that. We want it to come out. I was like, okay, that's all right. And so then I wrote the draft that I had plans for book three. And it was pretty much very similar to this plot-wise, but execution-wise, it was not working.
Oh, wow.
It just didn't work. And I was like, oh, my God, I don't know what's happened. And so I tried another draft of it, and again, still not working. So I sort of grew a bit panicky about this. So I just tried something completely different for the third first draft of Nemesis 3 and of Diabolik 3. And this one's just Nemesis on a rampage across the empire, getting revenge and stuff like that, which is so much fun to write. But the thing is, it's like, you can't really turn your protagonist into a super villain in book three and then turn it around. It's like, there's no way to turn that back around.
Right.
It's like, you know, they start just rampaging ridiculously. It was like Nemesis and Anguish team up and just are like, screw humans, we're going to... You know, they betrayed us for the last time. It was fun, but it was like my editor was like, you can't do this.
Oh, yeah, I would actually maybe read that, though, yeah.
I don't know. I might put it out in some form as an alternate evil universe novel, but the problem was it's just not, there was nowhere to go once you really start doing that. And it kind of obliterated the entire thing I had planned.
Yeah, yeah.
So I tried to incorporate some of that into book draft four, and then we're getting closer to there, so I did draft five where it was almost there, and then draft six I finally got it.
Nice.
So
yay.
it was a long process of getting it right, but as soon as I had this draft number six of this one, and it was pretty much full rewrites the entire time. I think the only scene that remained of the Nemesis rampage version was it's the scene where she goes into this asteroid.
Oh, yeah, the library.
And she's just charging through it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was from the other version.
Ah, okay. Yeah,
like, okay,
yeah.
I want to keep this.
Yeah, but we still have to. We still have to see that. So do you get, as long as we're writing, is your publisher kind of happy, or do you get these like passive aggressive emails of can't wait for the next book to come out? Because if you're supposed to have a trilogy and they're waiting on a third book.
It depends on your publisher and your editor. Right. My editor is fantastic. He actually was just like, I just want the right book out there.
Great.
And he was incredibly patient with me. And probably, unfortunately, because of my timing, it came out in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah.
None of the timing has been right with this book. The first book actually came out the week after the 2016 election. So it was also kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah, the timing has not worked in our favor. But... Yeah. He cares about the integrity of the book that comes out. And that's honestly, you can't ask for anything better than that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I don't know if this is a rule or not, if this could be asked. Does that mean that your next book, do you go to that editor first, or does your agent, or if it's going to be a different style book, then your agent might look somewhere else once you've built a rapport with an editor?
I think that editor always will get the first,
look, the first look.
Especially once you've established a working relationship with someone and you work well together.
Yeah.
That's so valuable. It really, it really means a lot. Like, with Insignia, with that series, I started the first two with a wonderful editor, Molly O'Neill, who's now an agent.
Oh, yeah.
Actually with my literary agency, so that's awesome.
Yeah.
But then I had a couple of editors. I had like three editors for book number three. And, you know, it's like that happens a lot in publishing. It's a business that's really changing around. So it's like when you find something where you click with someone, it's pretty amazing to have. And I think as an asset, that's an extraordinary one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I just got to ask a side question, because they always say that authors, you know, they don't have a lot of say in your covers, but look at the Diabolik cover. So you have the first one with the blades on the butterfly, which is really like, oh, and then all of a sudden you have the exploding one. How do you like your covers for the Diabolik series?
I love the covers. I think they're amazing. The only one where I really was an interfering busybody was book three.
Okay.
Just because I had an image in the book that I just thought would be an amazing cover.
Right.
And I think the original cover that was drafted for it was sort of based on a previous draft, where it kind of was sort of this metaphorical version of the chrysanthemum, which just didn't fit the story, I didn't think. And also there's an animal motif with a, you know, butterfly, not animal, living creature, butterfly, you know. And with this one, I was just, I was like, you know, it's like, well, not an animal, but just a living entity at the center of it. And I really wanted this cover, and I kind of described it a bit, and yeah, I you know, they went back a couple times, like, okay, this is the last one. I was like, that's it. That's beautiful.
Nice. Also, the font on it is pretty cool. I don't know where they discovered that font from, but for the title.
Which one?
The title, the title font is also pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, I love that font too. I mean, I wish I had it on my computer and make swag off of it. But no, they do good covers. Simon and Schuster does. They have a real sense of what looks good.
Yeah.
I mean, like that first Diabolik book, that butterfly, that was done in house.
Wow.
And that's just, it's an epic image.
Yeah.
And it was so perfect for what it was showing.
Yeah. And also I was biased for like very clean covers that just have like a sharp image on it. That's going to like an impactful image. So I'm really, I would totally buy the books just for the covers.
That's great. Hopefully other people will do that too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could, people read the books also. I have the trilogy is sitting here. I'm looking at it right now. Well, I have to get the insignia one also, but just read the books, people. So now here's something. Do you read a lot of sci-fi or did you have to research sci-fi to write this series or because we do have the Roman that you were looking to the, you know, Roman stuff, but you have a lot of sci-fi here. So how much of that do you have to kind of research or kind of be familiar with that world, and how much of it, how much freedom do you have with it?
Yeah. With science fiction, I don't read a tremendous amount of science fiction. I watched science fiction growing up, and I was a huge Star Trek fan growing up. So my mind kind of automatically goes towards science fiction. And with the first six books that I didn't sell, you know, they were sort of either contemporary or slightly fantasy. With number six, I sort of start getting into a mix of fantasy and sci-fi. I was like, I like this sci-fi thing. It just feels right to me. So then with seven, I just did pure sci-fi, and that was Insignia. And that's kind of where I felt comfortable. And actually, in a few things I've started and stopped, I've tried fantasy or paranormal. It's like, you know, I just feel, I like sci-fi. I like that you can try to think of something that could possibly work within the laws of the universe we exist within, you know?
Right.
And so mostly what I read, and I think it kind of shows with a, you know, Diabolik, is I love historical fiction.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. And I especially love Tudor England.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I've probably read almost everything, every novel about Elizabeth the First, for example. So, you know, I mean, that was probably the most influential thing. And, you know, I actually do research when there's something that I am missing. For example, originally I had, instead of hyperspace, I had subspace. And then I was actually dating a rocket scientist at the time. He's like, that makes no sense. Okay, hyperspace.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. That's hi, I have a question. No, not about it. I just need to know stuff for science stuff. Okay, bye. That works. So that's because that's interesting. Like, so, and then you also went to YA instead of, my bad, that you chose to do YA. I mean, sci-fi, I know they're trying to push sci-fi more, but it isn't necessarily so huge yet in YA. Yeah. Like, fantasy is really the genre and kind of contemporary also. So did you kind of fall into YA, or did you intend always to do YA?
Actually, it was YA that I first started writing.
Okay.
You know, it was partly because it was everywhere at the time, so you could just sort of pick it up and read it. And also, I really appreciate the pace of YA.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that you don't really waste time with YA. You don't have long ruminations, and then you don't have to discuss taxes and mortgages.
Yeah.
And, it's a fascinating time of life to me. When you're a teenager, you're basically at a point where who you are as an adult is taking shape, right. And yet you don't have any, generally, you don't have any autonomy or power over your life like an adult has. I guess right. Diabolik, that's partly why it's older YA, because they're, and also probably like any time you're writing people in sort of who are powerful, who have temporal power in their world, they're not going to have the same restrictions that most young adults do. But generally, it's like you have a mind, the mind of an adult in a way, and yet you do not get to choose who you interact with. You do not get to choose what you're doing, you know, and I think that's a really interesting dichotomy.
Yeah. Well, the first book definitely starts off like that, because that nemesis is, she's under the control of the family of, okay, you got to go fill in, you got to go do these things. And she does eventually kind of move away from that, like come into her own. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And I also, there's just so much time passes over the course of the book, and Tyrus is just the heir at that point. And basically he's the emperor after that. You can't really get much more emperor of the galaxy.
you can't really get much
more autonomy than that.
Oh yeah, that's true. that's very true. I also don't want to spoil the nemesis too much, but I do have one question. At the end, that it's like 2,500 years later, that she comes to get him in this spaceship. Aren't they going to land somewhere that someone's going to look at that spaceship and be like, "That's not from this time"? That's the only thing I was wondering.
Possibly. That could happen.
Unless they're going unless they're going to like a field somewhere and living by themselves, or they're going to think like, no, we refurbish antiques maybe. That, like, because that's always going to be a hobby, I think, that, right? So when you try to take the old cars and you're driving around your 1950 Chevy, so like that's the version of the 2,500 years later is the refurbishing the 1950 Chevy maybe.
Well, you know, partly with the technology and the Diabolik, so the mythos behind it is that, you know, they had this much more advanced species on Earth, these sort of machine men. They created these ships that were sort of self-repairing with bots that would repair each other, et cetera. So everything has sort of stagnated. They've been using the same technology for all this time. So I guess, like, you know, hypothetically, the technology they use would still probably be in pretty decent shape a couple thousand years later. But however, it's like, I think, if you consider the high-profile nature of both Nemesis and Tyrus, you know, what role they would play in this galaxy's history, it's possible 2,500 years later would not be later enough to really make enough of a difference, in which case the black hole's still there. They can just go a bit more forward.
So. Well, just because for them it'll be like, what, a 10-minute time jump to another 2,500 years.
Yes, exactly.
That's actually kind of, that's funny. Well, I guess nobody really knows if that's possible, right? Because we don't really know enough about black holes to know if you can actually do that. So that does give you wiggle room to make up whatever you want about a black hole. Or are some people like, that's not the way a black hole works?
Well, actually, as reading about, I read many, a long time ago when it first came out. So I was probably, I don't know how old I was. There was a book by Neil deGrasse Tyson. And it was about what would happen if you fell into a black hole. And that's kind of what I had in mind for that, because time slows down and slows down and slows down. Basically, you would seem to be falling forever to anyone from the outside.
Right.
And then inside of it, it would just be minutes for you. So in a way, it is kind of like traveling through time, just because the gravity, you would just seem to be completely still. People could look at you for millions of years, and they'd be like, wow, that person's still in the same spot. But for you, it's just minutes. And, you know, when I was thinking of galactic religion, it was kind of just centered around the idea of that kind of being their equivalent of hell, just the idea of being removed forever from the rest of the cosmos.
Right.
You know, and if you're ascendant, it's kind of like being returned to a star where you'll become part of the cosmos once more.
Well, actually, okay, I just thought of this hypothetically. Mm-hmm. If Nemesis disappears from her time zone, does there become a myth around for the people who are left behind? Like, what happens to her story then? Is she just, she saved the galaxy and then she kind of just faded, You know, she kind of looped, I'm going to make it into a verb now. She looped off to another planet and then just let the Jedi keep going? Or does, do you have imposters to pin?
A mythology would arise about that, you know, because she was someone, she came back from the dead and saved the galaxy against the evil tyrants. And then she went off and left them. So, you know, I mean, I assume she would become the stuff of legends for sure.
Yeah, that actually... That fits. I think that's a nice, that fits very nicely. Okay. Awesome. 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 So not because we're running out of things to say, but just because our time is limited. Is there anything else you want to say before I wrap up? Is there anything else you want to just add about writing or about, or anything before I ask you? I always end with I love it when either writers or publishers or agents, whomever, you want to fill in the blank there. And then I really can't stand it when, and fill in the blank there. But is there anything you'd want to add in before we wrap up with that, with the fill in the blank?
Well, I guess if anyone is listening and you guys have been with this series for these last several years, thank you for your patience. I really appreciate the fact that people have been so enthusiastic about these characters, and I really hope that it is paid off in the end.
Amen.
Hope it is satisfied.
I had to mark it. I think I marked it on my Goodreads. And then one of the things that you have to keep remembering. I was like, is this out yet? I had to keep checking. Like, is this out yet? Is this out yet? And then I'd forget about it. And then I'd see it. Like, how come I only have two of the books on my shelf? Oh, yeah. The third one didn't come back yet. Yeah. Pay attention, people. Mark it on your Goodreads. Okay. So now if you have a fill in the blank or if you want to skip it. But so far we're getting really interesting answers. For I love it when writers or publishers or whatever do X. Or I really don't like it when they do X. Do you have fill in the blanks for those?
I really like it when a writer, when I read something, and it's when I see something is surprising to me in a story, but I see the way it was prepared in advance. And then I connect it back and I have to reread again because I'm like, oh my God, okay, that's what that person had in mind. I'm gonna throw out a TV example of this, but Breaking Bad. That was a great show where you saw the ending, you're like, wow, okay, and you look back and you're like, okay, they always knew that's what they were going for. Right. I love that. I think it's really awesome.
Right.
So in the other words, I hate it when, let's see. I hate it when publishers cancel books mid series.
That's a good
gosh.
One. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's so frustrating.
Yes. I'm just going to, And I think people don't realize that it can happen, especially sometimes it's not necessarily because they could be selling well still, and sometimes they'll cancel it because, like you said, there's business stuff going on. People are moving around. I'm going to actually tag on.
And it's like, sometimes it's like you do need to get that conclusion and then you understand like what was happening before that. So that is something that the sense of incompleteness.
Yes.
That's the problem.
So true. And I'm going to tag on to that, even though it's not what you said. I'm going to tag on to that. I hate it when they change the covers, the style of the covers in the series.
Oh, yeah. I have not had that happen yet. But yes, I totally understand that. That would be, especially because, you know, sometimes you get the theme going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
it messes up my bookshelf.
But, you know, sometimes it is a great move. Like the Shatter Me series, the eye covers. Those are amazing, but it didn't start off with those covers.
Right, right.
And it's like they just needed to come up with those before the first book.
Right, right. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us. It's fantastic. It's been fantastic.
Thanks for having me, and I really love the questions. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. This was a bonus episode of Oh My Word Podcast featuring author S.J. Kincaid. To find out more about S.J. Kincaid and her work, please look at the link in the episode notes. To keep up with Oh My Word Podcast, follow us on Instagram or visit eltenenbaum.com and subscribe. Catch you next time.